We are rolling. We're rolling on. We are fired up.
Just remember my words, live and help live, and then everything will be okay.
It sounds like a song title. It really does.
Live and help live. Live and help live.
That's a collaborate. Is that a collaboration in the works? Well, you probably couldn't say if it was, but.
Well, you suggested the song, so that means you're my collaborator.
There you go.
Oh my God.
There you go, Dave.
I just wrote a song, co-wrote a little bit of a song with Desmond Child. Okay, I can die now. I can die
You've done
it.
it.
Hi everybody, this is Rob Halford.
The Rudy Sarge. Hi there, this is Steve Hackett.
Hey folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph. And we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Hey.
There he is, the legend, the hit maker to the stars, the star himself,
absolutely.
Desmond Child, living on a prayer. Big songs, big life. Oh man, this is awesome, Desmond. We've had you on a couple times over the years, but so it's the first time we've talked to you face to face via Zoom. Face to face to face, three faces. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fantastic. I mean, we're snowed up in our house here in Nashville. Can't get up, can't get down. Yeah, that's how we are.
Yes.
I'm just glad the internet's still working.
Yeah, we're going through the same thing. Go ahead. Say, yeah, Shane, you were saying you got that there in Philly, and same in Detroit here.
Philly right now, we're supposed to get about 6 to 8, and we lost internet in the building. So hopefully you see and hear me.
I just wonder what happened to global warming, man.
Yeah.
I know, right? I know.
What the fuck?
Every storm's like the storm of the century, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah.
Desmond, man, you know, when we've talked to you a couple of times before, and, you know, I always thought, you know, your life is one that would be an amazing book. And now we have an amazing book. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I always wonder if songwriting is some level of a catharsis, but writing a book must be that on a gargantuan level. Is that fair to say?
Well, it took 7 years, you know, so 7 years to write this. I mean, it was not an easy task. Because there was so much that every time you look at a story or whatever, you start to dig up other details. And then you realize you weren't remembering it like quite like how it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm like a truth person. So, you know, had to tell the truth.
Yeah.
What do people come to you, Desmond, to get the truth? Or do you have to find it from a lot of other people? Because, you know, as time goes on, things fade from memory. And, well, you know.
I did call people up and say, tell me exactly now, like, what happened.
Yeah.
But I had to do that with Steven Tyler. I had to sit him down and tell him the story of how we wrote Dude Looks Like a Lady. Because in his autobiography, he kind of, like, described me like I was like Juan Valdez, you know, the coffee dude, you know. He said I had a handlebar mustache. Okay. I've never had a mustache on its own, like without a beard to go with it. And it's never been handlebar. And, you know, not even in the 70s, like porn time, did I have a mustache, you know? And the father on the Brady Bunch or something, you know. I never, ever looked like that. And so then started to proceed saying the song was already written and that, you know, I just added a few, sprinkled just a few little words in there. And it's like, yeah, absolutely not true. And so then Joe writes his autobiography with my same, you know, before I did my book with my same co-author, David Ritz. And he tells the story like completely wrong. Also, he said, oh, it was Desmond's idea. It was Desmond's title, you know, and all this. It's like, no, it was Steven's title. And so I had to sit Steven down and And, you know, like face to face, I said, okay, let's go over the writing of Dude Looks Like a Lady. This is after his book came out and all that. And, you know, I told him how I, you know, showed up, and they started playing me this backward loop, and he started singing Cruising for the Ladies. You know, Cruising for the Ladies. And I hadn't even said hello. And I said, that's bad. I don't, and just try to get a rise out of them to laugh. I said, I don't think Van Halen would put that on the B side of their worst record. Because what are you talking about? You guys are like middle-aged guys talking about Cruising for the Ladies, what, top down in a pink, you know, convertible Cadillac down Sunset Strip, and girls are just jumping in the car. Is that the video that we need to see again? I mean, how many of those videos did we see?
Oh man.
And so you know, he's like looking at me. I said, you know, remember you told me that you went down to this bar on the shore, and there was this, you know, you went with your guys, you know, all the roadies and everything, you guys, you know, went for a beverage. I think they were all in the program, so it wasn't alcoholic. And the end of this long, lonely bar was this vision of loveliness, this platinum mullet with this curvy figure and porcelain skin and black nails and jewelry and, you know, midriff, right? And so they were all, say, you know, drawing straws who was going to go and say hello. And then she turns around and it's Vince Neil of Motley Crue.
That dude looks like a lady. There you go.
And then Steven started saying, "Ooh, that dude looks like a lady. Dude looks like a lady. Dude looks like a lady." That's how he described it. And so that's where the riff came out. And so then I'm sure that, you know, that idea was like nixed right away, because it's like they could never sing Dude Looks Like a Lady, like they were attracted to that or something.
Yeah.
And so I said, look, you know, Joe said, but we don't know what that means. You know, he's kind of like, you know, how he poses in his pictures, you know, like,
yeah.
Head back, you know.
Eyes. That's so him. Yeah. The pose.
But now this time he's like really back, you know, looking at me, and he said, you know, we don't want to insult the gay community. I said, dude, I'm gay, not insulted. Let's go down this road. It's funny. This is a hit title. So, you know, we proceeded to write the verses, and then, you know, all this, you know, and so you know, there was one part where Steven goes, my funky lady, I like it, like that. So the guy doesn't run away. He stays right with it, you know? And so, you know, that's why the second verse says, never judge a book by its cover, or who you gonna love by your lover. And so, you know, that's, you know, that's the moral of that story.
Yeah.
That, hey, you know, if it looks good to you, go for it and don't judge. And so we were like, you know, what, 40 years ahead of our time, you know, something like that, 30 something years, because now more than ever, you know, there are a lot of dudes that look like a lady, and, you know, that's what they're, you know, gender non-conforming, non-binary, you know. And, you know, I think that, you know, some people thought that the song was insulting, you know, to gay people. And it's like, no, dude, never judge a book by its cover or who you're going to love by your lover. That is the most open, like, accepting thing that one could say.
Yeah.
So so I'm telling Steven this story, and he's looking at me and he goes, I like your story better than mine. But you put it in your book, you know. I want to reprint.
So that's what's so important for, it's so important to get these stories out there, and I appreciate you writing the book and doing that. And what you just described, I mean, not the, you know, kind of misremembering on their part, but the process of song, is that like the heart of collaboration right there? What you just, you know, the playing off of ideas and things like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I've written with people, started writing with them 5 minutes after I met them. Mm. And sometimes there's chemistry and sometimes there's not. Yeah. But, you know, usually I get people to open up, you know, fast and, you know, kind of start getting them to spill the beans on their, what's going on with them. And I'm writing down everything they say and bingo, something comes up and it's like, okay, that's the title.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Does, and don't get me wrong, this, I'm just, because you were talking about it, and it's such an amazing song, Dude Looks Like a Lady. It's one of my favorite 80s songs and songs in general from that band. Do you think a song like that in today's PC culture could get out there and be as big as it was?
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's like everything's like canceled. Everything's canceled.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, except, you know, in certain genres, like an urban genre, you can just say whatever comes to your mind and it's all good.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the same, you know, one of the most like, you know, kind of restrictive genres of music is country music. Mm. Contemporary Christian music. It's all goes by a very strict book. You can almost get, you know, any male artist to sing the song. And, you know, people have various, you know, flares that are a little bit different from the other, but basically the storyline is the same dude. The same dude could sing that song.
Right.
So how are those decisions made? Because it's like, oh no, you can't say that. Oh, you gotta say that. Oh, well, you know, it's gotta be like a trucker. Oh, it's gotta be a bar. Oh, it's gotta be in the bed. Oh, you know, a divorce, cheating. I mean, the subjects are like very much the same. Hmm. And, you know, if you write something a little different, like in the day when Johnny Cash would, you know, sing a song like Hurt, you know, which, you know, he didn't write, but still he interpreted a song like that, that could never fly on, you know, contemporary, you know, radio, because, you know, it's just not about what those dudes would be singing about. And the same goes for the women. Usually it's like, you know, it started to switch, you know, with, you know, Carrie Underwood, you know, when he cheats and stuff like that, where it's like female empowerment, you know, I'm going to key your car, I'm going to slash your seats, you know, whatever she's like saying. It's like, it's usually that. And it's usually somebody, you know, that got jilted and then just, you know, had to discover themselves. And then all of a sudden they're strong again. And, you know, songs like that. But that's true for many songs, even in pop music, you know, like, you know, Katy Perry's like the queen of that, dark horse, you know, like all those kind of triumphant rising female empowerment songs, you know, Dua Lipa, Levitating, you know, all rising up. So, you know, that's the thing, like genres have like stereotypical archetypes, and then if you don't fit that archetype, you don't get played. It's not a go. Your talent would have to be so exceptional, like let's say a Kacey Musgraves or something like that, that just like, you know, she can cut through all of that and be herself and you know, win. But, you know, it's, you know, as the young boys and girls, you know, coming out of Belmont and Vanderbilt, you know, venture onto the row, which is like a block away, and try to you know, try to make it, they start to see that, you know, if they want to make it, they have to all look the same, act the same, talk the same. So you see, you know, kids that come in here from like Boston, you know, that are going, y'all, how y'all doing? It's like, excuse me, aren't you from Boston? You know, yeah. Or like New Jersey, how you's doing? No, it's how y'all doing, you know. Yeah. So it's conforming to the culture so that you fit in. And, you know, but you know what, the Hollywood system was the same way. You know, people would come in with these long kind of East European names, and suddenly they'd be, you know, Betty Grable, you know, or
yeah,
or Hedy Lamarr, you know, they'd be renamed to fit into some kind of mold that they would feel that the public wanted. But maybe it goes deeper than that, which is humanity's obsession with archetypes, because we're hardwired, let's say, to see something slithering on the ground and like jump and run the opposite direction. You know, sometimes it's just like, you know, a little piece of string, but we jump because we're hardwired, you know, even, you know, in the corner of our eye, something slithers, it's a snake and go. You know, so in the same way, we're hardwired to recognize, you know, universal archetypes. So if you look at the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses, you could see the same archetypes in movie stars or in rock stars, like Venus. Well, you know, that's Jean Harlow, that's, you know, Marilyn Monroe, that's Gwen Stefani, you know. You see Medusa, right? There's, you know, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Madonna, Lady Gaga, you know, people who would have, you know, snakes coming out of their head. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, you've seen some of those outfits Gaga has worn, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So her archetype, her archetype is very clear. And we recognize it, we're hardwired for it, and we buy it. And, you know, like the difference between, let's say, John Bon Jovi and Alice Cooper, you know, who is, you know, Apollo, you know, that's John Bon Jovi. Who is Pan? That's Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
I mean, even the imagery, you know, the way they look, you know, John looks like a Roman god, and Alice Cooper looks like, you know, all those pictures of Pan, you know, with the long nose and the, you know, the wicked face. And so we recognize those images and we're interested in them, even if they're negative images. And one of the interesting things was writing and producing Alice Cooper on our album called Trash.
Yes. I listened to that last night. I love that record.
And the thing is that when we first got together, he explained very clearly. He's the one that really gets it. That's why he's such a nice person, because he doesn't buy into the image he's created. That's just a fun thing that he did. You know, he was never going to be, you know, a matinee idol. You know, so he used his strange looks to his benefit. Even carrying a snake, you know. I mean, it's just like all perfect. And so he said, I'm Vincent Fournier. Alice Cooper is the character I play. And so when you write for Alice, you know, he would say in third person, you tell a certain kind of story. And because he's the son of a preacher man, all of his stories as Alice Cooper are morality plays. So if he cuts the head off a doll, then guess whose head comes off next? His, in the guillotine. See, he always gets comeuppance. He always gets punished for his evil ways. And so that's, you know, his role. And he's teaching people you know, the difference between good and bad. Not by being good, but by being bad.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of fun with it. And I was so proud when he came to Greece to perform in my show, An Evening of My Music, called Desmond Child Rocks the Parthenon. And we filmed it all, and that's going to be part of my career documentary, the making of that that show. And when he came out, I mean, people just went crazy. And he came out with a riding crop, you know, and he's like looking around, you know, it's like, you're poison and you're poison, you know, like, and, you know, this was at the Odeon of Herodotus Atticus, which was a 4,000 seater, well, more than that, 4,400, not 4,000, yeah, 4,400 seater that we sold out to the brim. And they have very strict rules. You can't even stand up because it's so steep that you could fall and cause a problem. So you have to remain seated. And you also, because it's a kind of sacred place, you can't use your phones. Well, I told everybody in the middle of my show, it's like, you know, like, take your phone out and put the flashlight on. I want to see, you know, I want to see this. You know, so I took mine and they all started doing it. You know, and we started singing the song that I wrote with Rock Mafia and Zed called Beautiful Now. And this, yeah. And it, well, we opened it with the bridge. Let's live tonight like fireflies and one by one light up the sky. And the video is amazing how they were all like just lighting up at the same. It's so, so good. So the Minister of Culture was there and she's like the very stern woman, right? And she's the one that makes up those rules, right? Mm-hmm. Sure enough, Alice Cooper comes out. She was filmed, and it caused a scandal, filming Alice Cooper singing all the words of Poison herself.
Wow.
You know, it was like so cool. So that's the power of Alice Cooper, and that's the power of a hit song that, you know, everybody in the world knows.
Yeah. Is it when you collaborate, is it because you're across genre, like you Bon Jovi, you know, obviously, and just to set it up for folks, you know, you collaborated with John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, Living on a Prayer, You Give Love a Bad Name, Poison, the Trash album with Alice Cooper. You mentioned Zed, you know, also Kings and Queens, you had a hit with Ava Max. Like, how do you approach, how much does genre factor in when you consider a collaboration?
Well, to me, it's like, it's all about the story. It's lyrics first, you know, and lyrics have style, you know, it's not just the music. And so you could write something and realize, no, this is way too urban sounding for this rocker to sing. Or you could go the other way. You could be working with an urban artist and, you know, they can't sing certain things because it just would sound awkward. It doesn't fit their culture. So it's all about lyric and it's all about story. So it's my job to help people tell their story. And then the music is secondary because that's the score for the film that they're presenting.
Yeah.
You always put the music. That's why the music budgets are so low, because the film's already run out of money by the time they get the composer.
They didn't know that well.
Yeah, absolutely. That, oh, well, we'll take it from the music budget, you know. Everybody's so desperate for work, they just do it, you know, just to get on something and keep going, you know. But that's the whole thing. It's like, I think that, you know, there have been a lot of advancements in technology. So pop music can be very interesting and creative with the, you know, so many things, sampling and this and that and the other thing. And so I really am excited about new music and I would love to work in it. And I can usually fit into any, you know, writing session. I write a lot with Antonina Armato and Tim James, Their duo, production duo, is called Rock Mafia. And we wrote for Selena Gomez. We have a single coming up soon with JoJo Siwa, coming out first. And, you know, she's a very young, amazing dancer. Oh, my God. She's just one of the best dancers ever. And so, you know, we're writing for young artists. You know, we've been writing for years. And we have a lot of songs that are kind of half done, you know, you know, that are kind of like sitting there waiting for the right artist to pitch it to. And sometimes the artist will listen to songs and say, yeah, but I'm like, well, come on, come co-write it, come up with different lyrics. And that's the way it goes. You have to be flexible, you know, these days. And, you know, it's to me, you know, everyone says, oh, you write in so many genres. It's like, no, people are people. I don't write, you know, for different species.
Yeah. Well, Desmond, you seem like a purist and you approach songwriting from a very organic angle. Do you, what are your thoughts? You know, AI has been a big thing the last year and a half. It's kind of taking over in a lot of ways. What are your thoughts on AI and songwriting? And do you think that's going to affect that organic value? Is it going to ruin songs or enhance them?
I don't know. We tried to ask AI to write a Desmond Child lyric, and it was like such crap. I mean, are my songs really that bad? You know, maybe they'll start improving, but it was just like, you know, in the heart of the darkness, you know, like kind of like those kind of lyrics. And, you know, the point is that I'm all for it. However, if they're going to use our content, they have to ask us permission. So that's consent. And they also have to give us credit for the content they use. And they have to compensate us. So that's three. You know, consent, credit, compensation. And that has to be in line with global trade norms. Because you can't have like somebody, you know, in the Cayman Islands now doing whatever they want and not paying us, right? You know, because the AI company decided, you know what, let's just get out of the States and go and live in paradise and, you know, mess everybody up. And so, you know, the countries of the world, I think that Europe, the EU, has now made advancements. You know, I don't think they're all the way there with it, because there's many aspects of the AI, which is like, let's say, taking somebody's voice and duplicating it, and then, you know, putting it out there as so-and-so, you know, and it's like, I didn't sing that. I know it sounds just like me, but that wasn't me. And so, you know, that's the dangerous part. I mean, you could do an AI of your kid looking like they were being kidnapped. And, you know, and sounds like them, looks like them. And then, you know, the guy in the mask, you know, says, you know, you go to the police, this kid's dead. How many movies have we seen that do that, right?
Yeah.
But with AI, it can really, really be dangerous. I mean, they even like show it on the Instagram, like cases where people, you know, get this frantic call, and then they call the person, they go, hi. It's like, are you okay? Yeah. What? You just called me saying you were being kidnapped. AI strikes again. And terrifying. So, and what about having the president of the United States come on TV and say, we are being attacked by aliens. Everybody, you know, we have like, you know, maybe, you know, four more minutes to live, you know, whatever, hide, you know, or something like that. I mean, it looks exactly like whoever the president is.
grab your lover. Time's up. You grab your lover.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, it's that's the terrifying part about it, if there's no control. Yeah. So, you know, I'm on the board of ASCAP, and we went to Washington a few months ago, and we went, you know, from, you know, congressmen, senators, and all that to explain. They didn't even know what it was. They don't understand it. But what's happened is that these, you know, chat box people have gone in and scraped the Spotify, scraped the internet, scraped everything, and put it into their turbine of ideas and sounds and images, and without permission. And so, yeah, you want to pay me $2 million to, you know, fool around with my songs? Okay, give me the money.
Yeah.
Otherwise, take my shit out. Right. Don't use it. We have to have that control, because guess what? There are copyright laws already in place. You don't have to like have new legislation, just apply the laws of copyright. I'm sure there's things that we need to, it's more complicated than that. But the fact is that you can't just take somebody's song and put it in a TV commercial without negotiating for a fee.
Right.
And pay them.
Yeah.
Terms. Like, that's just the way it is. Because people confuse, you know, playing a song on the radio that anybody can hear with, you know, shit being for free. Well, if it's on terrestrial radio, they sell commercials. So then if they're going to use our music to get people to listen, then they have to pay us, you know? And if it's the other way around, let's say it's on a streamer or something like that, or let's say, you know, it's there's still a compensation, let's say a subscription model. So they're getting how many billions of dollars every month from all these hundreds of millions of subscribers, right? It adds up.
Mm-hmm.
And the content that they're streaming, the people that made it have to be paid. And, you know, what we're paid is like almost nothing. But it adds up. It's a nickel and dime business. Always has been. Yeah.
When will that get do you see any of that getting fixed in the, you know, especially with streaming? And I mean, the CEO of Spotify said, well, artists have to do more to make more money, something like that, right, Shane? I think it was.
Yeah.
Like artists just have to be more, which seems so insulting. You know, like when, how do you think this will get
fixed? Who said that?
Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify. This was a few years. He said it a few times, but a couple of years ago, he said artists just have to be more creative. When artists were saying, well, you know, we're getting pennies on the dollar per stream, you know, or something like that. Which
if
was,
if you want
less than a penny, like point something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's less than a penny.
Right. Less than, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, it's like, I think we had gotten like, or in the early days, it was like, I don't know how many millions of streams on Living on a Prayer. And, you know, by the end of the year, I got my check. It was $6,000.
That's unbelievable.
Insane. Just,
I mean, that graceful. doesn't pay for 3 days of my overhead.
Yeah.
No joke.
Yeah.
You know, with kids in college and, you know, everything, my employees. You know, long ago, I had to go and lobby with Republican Congresswoman Mary Bono. She had taken over Sonny Bono's seat when he died. And, you know, she was very keen on getting it so that if, you know, before, if you sold your catalog, that was considered ordinary income tax. And it wasn't considered capital gains. But if you owned a matchbox company, you know, you sold your company, you could benefit from the capital gains. Now, what's the difference? So we had to go and explain to people that writing songs isn't just sitting on a porch with a banjo on your knee and a corn cob pipe. That's your overhead, you know, right. The tobacco that you put in the pipe. Right. That was your overhead, right? Because you made the moonshine yourself.
Right.
For free. Yeah. You know,
right.
It's like, no, we have to rent space for our equipment that's very expensive that we have to keep, you know, doing. We have to have a receptionist. We have to have an engineer. We have to have an assistant engineer. It's like flying a plane.
Yeah.
You know, we have to have lawyers to negotiate our deal. We have to have managers that any penny comes in, we have to pay them their 15%. We have, you know, like agents. We have so many, you know, so many people we have to pay to create our business like any other business. And we had to go from office to office to office to explain this. And finally, we got this. This was during the Clinton times. Mm. But we still have to do that today. Because people, you know, all these newbies are there, these, you know, that really don't know anything about music. You know, all they care about is, you know, who knows what they care about. They don't seem to care about much but themselves. And explain what our business is all about. And the, you know, the long tail of people that, you know, that derive their income from the money that we make beyond the business, you know, our lives, you know, school, kids, doctors, everything. It's like the ecosystem. And if you stop the money flow, which is deserved for the fact that we, in this country, the music education got early on because it was reading, writing, and arithmetic. The No Child Left Behind. It's like No Child Left Untested, right. You know? And, you know, creativity was at a low, you know, value. Even though it takes a lot of creativity to put a man on the moon, you know, and if you don't give kids opportunity to open those parts of their brain, you know, then, you know, you start losing your competitive edge in the world. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that happen now. All these other countries landing on the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just sent something up that burned up. Hello.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what? We were there first, but you see that the values changed. And so creativity then is all on you. So you have to educate yourself. Your parents have to put you with private classes to learn your instrument. So on top of the fact that, you know, it costs so much to live, they sacrifice to get lessons for their kids. So then how do you get good at something, you know, and then be of value to society that way?
Right.
So, you know, there's so many things. And then at the end of it all, after we've paid for everything and made something out of ourselves with public domain, we lose our rights to the things we created. But do the Vanderbilts give up their mansions?
Nope.
No.
No.
No. And I'm like, you know, not a fan of public domain, not because, you know, I don't want to help the earth. Let's say my lineage just died out. I would love to say in my will, hey, if everybody dies out forever on afterwards, any royalties that come in for my songs, let's say they're still popular 100 years from now, let it go to the Red Cross. Not just not be paid. Because right. If you look at it, the ones that benefit from not be paid isn't the public. Because if you're going to buy music of a public domain work, let's say Beethoven or whatever, you still have to pay. The one that doesn't have to pay is the record company, the royalties to a composer or their estate. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where's the public domain? All of a sudden, those records aren't less expensive.
Right. Same price.
Nobody's like put those two things together. it's not it doesn't benefit society. Also, it doesn't benefit society to not have an estate that cares about keeping the music alive of the person that died. If it goes to public domain, nobody cares. And millions of songs will just disappear because there's nobody to remember them or care.
Which is terrifying. So, yeah.
You know, I, you know, that's been a long time gripe of mine. And every time I bring it up, people say that you can never get that changed, because that's been in laws ever since the Roman times, the idea of public domain.
Right.
You know, so it's really embedded into, you know, the laws of the world. But it doesn't benefit the public.
Yeah. If it goes away, yeah.
It doesn't benefit the distributors.
Yeah.
Well, did...
So anyway, I'm sorry I went off on those tangents.
No,
we love it.
Yeah, it's educational.
That people see, you know, the total picture of, you know, and really appreciate if you go into a restaurant and you hear music and suddenly somebody flipped the switch and the music was off. You know what you hear? You hear this.
Deadly.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
And people talking.
Yeah.
And you want to get out of there. When the music is on, you relax. And all of a sudden you feel like you're in this groovy, cool place, you know, with the kind of music. You want to go eat barbecue? Well, you better be listening to Patsy Cline and Johnny Cash when you go in there.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're going to go into some like fancy French restaurant, you want to hear like cool jazz, you know, and feel like you're elegant. So almost everywhere you go, music is playing. Elevator, lobby, just walking through your house. Music is everywhere. And we need to be paid for it. You know, the restaurant lobbies have for years tried to get it so that they can just use our music for free. And you know how much they pay just a typical restaurant? It's usually by, you know, like capacity. Mm-hmm. Let's say a formula is made. They pay like $200 a year.
That's it?
Oh, my God. Music.
Wow.
Almost nothing, not even a dollar a day.
That's crazy.
Of our music nonstop in a hotel lobby. You can be walk in at 4 a.m. and there's still some very nice little soft music playing.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel like, oh, I'm in a great place. And so, you know, those people, those lobbyists, you know, are paid a lot of money by the, you know, the people, you know, hotel, lobby, restaurant people, you know, to try to knock that out. But that's called general licensing. And in performance rights organizations, that accounts for a third of our income.
Wow.
Elevator music, man.
Yeah.
It's like music is everywhere. A third. And another third comes from, let's say, you know, all kinds of licenses we have with Netflix and terrestrial radio, all of that, iHeart and all this kind of stuff. Then the other third comes from foreign usages, which are usually, think of how big the world is, right?
Yeah.
And compared to our population, right? It's only a minuscule amount that we get, and it still accounts for a third of our income. So that's why we have to be out there fighting all the time to make sure that our reciprocal trade agreements are in order and that, you know, we play their music, we send them a check. They play our music, they have to send us a check.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you know, it sounds like a lot of bureaucracy and everything, but if you know, the performance rights organizations that exist, and in the United States, we have four: ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and GMR. And there could be more in the future. I mean, most countries only have one, you know, except for really large countries like Brazil, you know, they have like three. But, you know, and the history of those is very interesting. King Henry VIII had a bunch of friends. He was a musician himself. And his friends were all like in the court and they were bums. And, you know, he had to constantly be supporting them. So he made it a law that if their music is played in a pub, they had to pay something for that. And that's why they're called royalties. Royal. Mm,
that's where it came from. Wow.
That's where it came from.
Wow.
And so then guilds were established in every country, like hundreds of years ago, to collect these usages and so that the musicians could keep writing instead of plowing a field, let's say. You know, their talents were better spent coming up with a madrigal, let's say. So that's the history of the performance rights organizations. Before there were records, before there was even printed music. And so how cool is that?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And so, there's a long history of this. And, we need to maintain this tradition in order to help the world, because what would the world be like without music?
Yeah.
It would totally suck. Or how about, you can have music, but AI made it. Look how cool it sounds.
Yeah.
Hmm.
No, that's
that sounds thrilling.
It's frightening. I know.
Right. The AI Sade. Let's see what that sounds like.
Yeah. There's an AI George Carlin bit that doesn't sound like George Carlin.
Yeah.
Just came out. Actually, I think it's an impression, but still it doesn't sound, you know.
No.
Okay, so 100 years from now, you know, what's the use of us anymore?
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
You know, well, you could say, well, these artificial intelligence and robots and all this kind of stuff is just an extension of our humanity so that we can survive a toxic world where we can't breathe anymore.
Yeah.
And then our history or whatever, or the fact that, you know, we existed or whatever, is retained in their memory banks, I guess. And they'll figure out a way of making these things self-propelling eternally. I mean, we've seen movies about it, right?
Yeah.
I say if it's thinkable, it's doable.
Mm-hmm.
But really, how you know, we'll be long gone. Well, maybe not you guys, but I will be. I have sons that, you know, my husband and I have 21-year-old twin sons, Roman and Nero. In fact, we have a movie about it, a documentary called Two, the Story of Roman and Nero.
Yeah.
I love their names. Great names.
NYRO, because Nero's named after Laura Nero, the composer, who was my friend and died. And, you know, so I named him in honor of her. And so, you know, what's their future going to look like? You know, I mean, I just shudder to think about it. If things keep going the way they are, because both of my parents came from Soviet occupied countries. And I saw how authoritarian regimes, you know, really hurt everything, the creativity, just freedom, just to be able to be yourself and all of these things. And, you know, if you look around the world, how many countries are democratic compared to, in terms of population, compared to the, you know, authoritarian?
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm so puzzled that Americans would think it's cool to go in that direction than just give up on democracy. Because like the guy they admire, you know, they're good with it, you know? And so it's very, very frightening. that that would happen, because what made us the shining light that made everybody want to come here, that light's being snuffed out. Like the, you know, I heard one of these crazy congressmen said they want to pull out the Statue of Liberty and send it back to France. It's like, no, thank you. We don't accept your gift anymore. A symbol of freedom and democracy and a light into the world. I wrote a song for Barbara Streisand called Lady Liberty. And if you go on the internet and look at the lyric video, you know, and she sang it like she was 20 years old. I mean, she sang it so beautifully.
Yeah.
Because she really meant a lot to her. And it's on her new album, also a compilation called Evergreens.
Mm.
And I'm getting ready to record a new song with her in a few weeks with a 60-piece orchestra.
What's the song? You got what's this song called?
I can't say.
Okay.
I can't say.
But the song was written for my musical called Cuba Libre, which means Free Cuba. And it's a Broadway musical I've been working on for 18 years, and it's moving forward. It's still moving forward. And so she heard the song and just said, you know, she for 2 years, she hasn't gotten off the song. So we're actually now booked to, I'm co-producing it with Walter A. and Peter Asher. And the arrangement will be by Walter A. and Bill Ross, one of her favorite arrangers. So I could not be more thrilled. And so, you know, I mean, that's somebody who made herself out of nothing, with nobody believing in her. And, you know, she's really an intellectual and creative genius. People don't understand how profound her intellect is.
Yeah.
And I mean, like her music, you know, the Evergreen collection is great. It's like 60 years of her career, the highlights, and my song Lady Liberty got on it. Yeah.